Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Construction of the California Capitol Annex building in Sacramento was first funded in 2017, with completion set for 2025. That was before activists mounted legal challenges with concerns for the California Environmental Quality Act, also known as CEQA. The Capitol Annex houses offices for the governor as well as state lawmakers and has needed updates for many years. Initially built in the 1950s, the Annex building isn't up to date with all compliance standards, and it was initially designed for a part-time legislature 70 years ago. But as California grew, so did the government, and more workspaces are needed. Yet, judicial rulings in the name of CEQA have halted its progress. CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon catches us up on where things stand today. Thanks for joining us, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
So you have been covering the saga of the Capitol Annex really since 2021. So there has been some progress in the past 2 years, but the renovation quickly ran into some roadblocks. So just give us a timeline of how things unfolded.
Yeah. So like you mentioned, this project was funded a few years ago. They built a temporary office space down the street on O Street. Lawmakers moved into that space in late 2021. So they've been like kind of crossing the street from their offices. There are some hearing rooms in that building, but the main Capitol, there's no work planned on the main Capitol building. It's the annex, which is the office space. And then there are a few other components of this project that have been sort of held up due to this lawsuit that we can get into later.
Yeah. What does it look like today for those who haven't been to the state Capitol in a couple years?
There's fencing up across much of Capitol Park. The annex is completely, you know, shut down. They're like removing a lot of the stuff inside, the walls, the electrical. That building could be demolished at any time. But other components of this project, you know, are held up because of this lawsuit that was filed, I think, in early 2022. A ruling on that lawsuit a few months ago in January said that the state could move forward with demolishing the annex. But the planned design for what it will look like, the court said that did not undergo proper public comment. And then the placement of a visitor center was also, you know, found to be the court said that the legislature didn't get public review on that portion, the design of the annex and a planned visitor center for the west side. So the state will have to go back and revise those plans and then recirculate them for public comment. But we don't know when that will happen. And lawmakers aren't saying much about that.
How significant of a renovation is this? So the annex project began like 70 years ago. How big of a deal is this?
I mean, It's a complete demo as things are right now. This was a huge part of this lawsuit. You know, preservationists had sued, arguing that the state decided to just demolish the annex and that it could be rehabilitated for cheaper. They used some arguments about, you know, state historical places to try to preserve the building. But the court ruled that the building can be demolished. The state can go forward with that. It's just, you know, the plans that are kind of in limbo right now.
So there may be some agreement that an improvement is needed and the building as it stands now is outdated. When it comes to like current safety or compliance standards, what are some of the concerning issues with the building?
Yeah, I mean, most people I've talked to, I think everybody agrees that something needed to happen with this building. It's 70 years old. There was admittedly asbestos in the pipes and lead paint, things that just really were not up to safety code. It was also very difficult to navigate for people in wheelchairs and crutches, just really narrow, cramped hallways, especially on busy days. The floors didn't align. So when you would go in the main Capitol, the buildings are like connected through hallways, so they're separate buildings. But you would walk up the stairs to the second floor of the historic Capitol, and then you would cross over to the annex, and it would be the third floor, and then you couldn't get to the fourth floor from either building. So it was just something needed to be done, and I think everybody agrees about that. But there's been a lot of disagreement about what actually that would look like.
I'm smiling because you're bringing up a lot of stressful memories for me as a new reporter in Sacramento trying to figure out the state capitol in a rush, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, why am I here? Like, it can be really confusing and difficult.
Yeah, and well, a lot of the argument about this project as a whole is like the visitor experience. I mean, you know, as a reporter and people who work in the building every day get used to those things, but a former state lawmaker in charge of this project had argued that it would really improve the visitor experience to make a new visitor center, to make the floors of the two buildings aligned, and to separate kind of the traffic from the day-to-day, the people who are in the building every day for work versus like the tour groups in the visitor center, having a separate entrance, having, you know, separate space to have that educational, like, state government experience, and then enter up through the Capitol in a separate area.
You brought up the legal challenges that are essentially halting this project. What are the main arguments that are being made? I mean, you mentioned preservationists, but there's more than one lawsuit, correct?
There were more than one lawsuit. I think they, you know, I think one didn't go forward, but the one that was ruled on was about, you know, they had all these arguments about trying to preserve the annex, that the state didn't get proper public feedback. You know, the ruling was that it violated CEQA, but it was more about like that the state hadn't gotten proper public input. You know, their plans changed from the time that the plans were first circulated, I think in like 2017, those plans progressed and the public wasn't allowed a chance to weigh in on the design of the building. They had decided that it would be this glass building, which had gone against one of their goals to have like have the material of the new annex be similar to the historic Capitol, to have a flow. But the Capitol's granite. And then this new building was glass, so the court ruled that it needed new public input on that.
Mm. And were there arguments also for the trees that would be impacted as well?
Yeah, that was another I think it was a separate lawsuit. And like I said, the court has ruled that a lot of the a lot of the trees are already uprooted. Some of them are in boxes on the Capitol grounds and have been for about a year. And I know that's been a huge concern for people concerned about the trees, but there are also plans to, you know, move them and try to preserve them. But I think the lawsuit said that those, you know, that's settled.
Yeah. There's just so much that's going on and that has happened in, you know, nearly 2 years. When I had to refresh my memory from your reporting. I'm like, wow, this goes back to 2021 when you began reporting on this. Your story out this morning, though, updating this progress, really focuses on the West Steps. And that is the site where there are many large protests and rallies in Sacramento that have taken place. It's also really the site where big marches come to an end. So what's in store for the west side of the Capitol?
Yeah. So the plan now, and again, the state will have to revise and recirculate these plans for public comment, but we don't know what they are yet because that revised plan has not come out. But the plan as it stands is to excavate the West Steps, a 20-foot pit, and build a visitor center similar to the U.S. Capitol. If you've been there, you know, tourists are directed underground to an underground visitor center. That's where a lot of the tours kick off, and then you go up into the Capitol. So it would be similar here. You know, all the school groups would enter near 10th Street, kind of walk down a sloping ramp into a visitor center beneath the West Steps. A lot of that space would still be accessible to walk on to have events. I want to make that clear. But it would be cut in like a third or half of that space would be devoted to the entrance and ramps sloping downward to that entrance. So there would also be a skylight that would be raised up above the ground a little bit. So that could impact, you know, it would be right in the center of sort of that gathering space.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have been to the West Steps many a times. I mean, has the legislature said anything about these changes and the impact that could have?
Not since the lawsuit. I've asked many, many times for interview requests, statement. The most recent statement I got a few weeks ago was from the new chairs of the Joint Rules Committee. And that's another aspect of this, is there's been some turnover in the legislature saying that they've been advised not to talk about this because of litigation. But that lawsuit ended in January.
Hmm. You did hear from one state lawmaker, Assemblymember Josh Hoover. He's a Republican. He represents the area of Folsom. And he has a bill that would actually protect the West Step. So what is his argument for doing this? What would this bill accomplish?
Yeah, it would basically stop construction on the West Steps. He and others, Hoover's a Republican. The other issue here is that Hoover took over the seat of the lawmaker who had been in charge of this. So Ken Cooley of Rancho Cordova is the state lawmaker who had been really pushing and overseeing this project. He lost re-election. Hoover says that this was an issue in the campaign. So he has a bill that would protect the West Steps, stop the visitor center, have it be built somewhere else. And he has just an argument for this is a historic place for people to gather. So here's him talking about that.
This has become an iconic location for people to come and petition their government. Over the years, we have had small business owners, union organizations, law enforcement, social justice advocates, civil rights leaders, environmentalists, Democrats, and Republicans come to these steps and petition their government on a number of different issues. And that goes away with the current version of the project. And that is really what I am most concerned about. I think we need to preserve these West Steps, not just for our current generation, but for generations to come. And I look forward to being a part of that solution.
Is he alone in this, or is there also an argument for moving forward and building the new visitor center on the West Steps?
He is not alone in this. I think there are other people in Sacramento that are concerned about the project as a whole. If you've been around the Capitol lately, it's a construction zone. There's lanes closed around. It's really affected the ability to park around that area, around Capitol Park. Business owners are really concerned about that and its effects on their business. And people are just concerned about the fact that you know, this project isn't exactly what they were told at the beginning. It was supposed to be completed in 2025. Well, the annex is still standing. The visitor center, we're not even sure if that will happen in that spot. It could, but it's going to definitely take more than 2 years probably to build those two things, as well as a parking garage. And I just want to, you know, note that it's not just the huge protests that take place there. Like, there's press conferences for advocates on these steps. Governors have taken the oath of office here. There's a wine festival there every year. And will these events be able to happen on the west side if that visitor center is built? Probably. But the space that it would take up would really affect the ability for a lot, like thousands of people, to gather there.
Yeah, I mean, that end of the state capitol is so historic and is the site of a lot of historic events that have taken place over the course of decades. You're talking about a very complicated situation that seems to get more complicated as more time goes on. And now we have another challenge, right? So the legislature is projecting a budget shortfall of more than $22 billion. How will this deficit impact this construction if it's even allowed to move forward?
I think some money has been set aside already. But again, we're not sure exactly. The price tag has gone up since the original estimate.
It's more than $1 billion, right?
And I think that's a few years old already. So you think about the supply chain issues and the construction and the length that this will probably go on longer than 2025. So that will increase the cost. And that is also a huge concern for opponents of this project, like Josh Hoover and other opponents. You had asked about an argument for the visitor center. I mentioned Ken Cooley. I actually bumped into him at the Capitol a few days ago, and he was happy to talk to me about that. You know, we went outside and he gave me the argument that he's been giving about the visitor center for a few years, you know, talking about how it would reduce crowding, really enhance the visitor experience, and offer more educational opportunities about, you know, the role of state government and democracy. And again, he insists there will be plenty of space to have rallies on top of the visitor center. He also did mention that the annex project as a whole would really open up the entire Capitol Park, including the east side of the building. And so he mentioned that it's possible that large events might move and be held in that space if all goes according to plan. Yeah.
Finally, Nicole, you reported more than a year ago that people, or about a year ago, that people were moving. Obviously, they're now across the street. This is all kind of in limbo, given that you actually go to the state capitol, you talk to people. I mean, what is the sense that you have from employees and also the business community that's impacted, and there's really an uncertain future as it stands right now? We don't know when it's going to be completed.
Yeah, that's hard to say. I mean, change is hard, and it's called the Swing Space, this new building, is an improvement in a lot of ways. Like, there's windows for a lot of offices that didn't have windows. There's natural light. You may have seen some chatter about the elevators being a huge issue, and I've experienced that firsthand. Also, you know, it's there's not a lot of privacy in these offices, is what I've heard. It's like a very fishbowl, a situation which can be hard when staff is like talking about sensitive issues. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's just hard to know for staff because they don't know when they may be able to transition back. They don't know what the new annex will even look like. So a lot going on here, and this whole saga is definitely not over.
Yeah, not for you either. More reporting for you. Thanks so much, Nicole.
Thank you.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's politics reporter, updating us on the challenges facing the state capitol annex building, which has renovation in limbo following lawsuits. Up next, we'll learn about the evolution of Asian enclaves like Chinatowns and the place they hold for Asian Americans and their sense of belonging. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There are more than 50 Chinatowns across the country, and the oldest calls California home. San Francisco is not only the oldest, but it is also the largest, established 175 years ago in 1848. Since then, we have a network of Asian American enclaves, from Little Saigon in Sacramento to Japantowns, Koreatowns, the list goes on and on. But these communities have evolved over the decades, and in many cases take on a different purpose from why they originated in the first place. Cap Radio's podcast, Mid-Pacific, explores what it means to be Asian American through food, family, politics, and so much more. The newest episode just dropped today, diving into what these towns hold for Asian Americans today when it comes to their sense of belonging. And in the spirit of evolution, we'll learn how new Asian ethnic enclaves are taking shape to preserve their culture in America. Sarah Mizestan is the host of Mid-Pacific and joins us now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Vicky.
So you are tackling some really like big questions in this latest episode. Where do we belong? Where do you feel at home? Where is home? So walk us through your thought process for this episode.
Yeah, definitely. I think the kind of main question of this episode is just, where is Asian America? That was kind of what I set out to kind of figure out, since Asian American is a term, and I kind of, you know, I think our whole podcast is about this feeling of in between and not really feeling like you belong anywhere. And so I wondered, you know, is there a place that we really do feel like we can find that belonging? You know, I myself have always felt a little displaced despite being born in this country. And I think it's kind of this universal feeling, because Asians are constantly being asked, where are they really from? And I kind of wish there was a place that you could be like, I'm from this place, and everyone would be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
but, you know, I've always been fascinated by places like Chinatowns, places that in some ways really do seem to be that home away from home for Asian Americans. Asians. For me personally, I grew up in New York, and Asian American neighborhoods in Queens ended up feeling more like home for me than the town that I'm actually from, just because these places were where my family would go to do groceries and eat familiar food. I'm sure you probably understand.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, when I visited San Francisco's Chinatown, a place that I'd argue feels like one of those very original homes for Asian Americans, I was really struck by how some of its residents felt similar to me and had very similar stories. One example is I spoke with resident or former resident Mei Shonig, whose grandfather immigrated from China to the United States to farm the land around the Central Valley. And her grandfather eventually married her grandmother, who was Chinese American and actually born in Grass Valley. Her grandparents did eventually move back to China at some point, but Mei mentions something that really the theme of our podcast, even back then in the early 1900s, you know, her grandmother felt that distinct Asian American feeling of not belonging.
I never knew until my mother's last years that my grandmother was really unhappy, because here she's born in America and she had all her siblings around her, and all of a sudden they send her back to China. And at first I was like, maybe there wasn't much difference, but there was, and because she didn't speak the dialect either. And so she always just kind of felt like she didn't have any friends, nobody to help her, and everybody just kind of ignored her. They just felt that she was just kind of, you know, a foreigner.
And I think that was like this big ha-ha moment for me. Just, you know, how far back Asian Americans go in history, and also how that feeling of not belonging, which felt so modern to me, actually existed even back then.
Oh, yeah. When talking with my mom, who's Japanese and English, my grandmother's Japanese, I mean, my grandmother had conversations with my mom like in the 1960s of that same exact feeling. So given that we're focusing, you start off the podcast, this episode specifically, in San Francisco's Chinatown, which on the surface, I mean, that feels like the obvious choice, right? But you really peel away these layers that we might not think about when visiting Chinatown. What were some of those big aha moments that you came across?
Yeah, definitely. So yes, at first glance, San Francisco Chinatown really feels like that place that if you were an Asian American searching for a place of belonging, you could go there and it might feel like home, right? but in actuality, I guess, especially today, modern times, I guess this and this holds for probably any town in America, honestly. Chinatown is constantly changing and turning over. When I visited, although I expected to feel kind of like I belonged or like, you know, there was like a similarity there, I actually felt distinctly out of place again. Chinatown today is much more geared towards non-Asian tourists, as I'm sure lots of folks already know. Mei Shonig grew up there, but she actually just brought up the fact that it wasn't her parents' intention for her to stay there and continue to preserve that sense of Asian American there. She moved out and away and went on to pursue her own version of the American dream.
And then, you know, the whole thing is things got better and better, and so people started moving further and further out, such to the point right now, San Francisco is pretty much all Chinatown.
I kind of like that. You know, San Francisco's all Chinatown. You don't need to go to San Francisco Chinatown to experience that. I kind of love that. And, you know, I don't know if that was an aha moment or if it was just something to think about, that this idea of a place of belonging is constantly changing for Asian Americans. And, you know, pinpointing one exact location of Asian American culture is going to be tough.
Yeah.
You know, even as these places, you know, Chinatowns, they just, I wish that they were permanent places of belonging, but unfortunately, even for San Francisco Chinatown, not the case.
Yeah, and it evolves. And obviously, San Francisco isn't the only home to a Chinatown or to an Asian American enclave, but are there parts of this history that's really unique to San Francisco? I mean, why was it the first and it's still the largest?
Yeah, great question. So I think the placement of San Francisco's Chinatown as a first landing place for people who are coming over from China played a huge role in its creation. So it was the first stop for people coming over to mine for gold, for folks who are not familiar, and they'd often look to buy supplies in San Francisco before heading inland to, you know, Sacramento and further out. And that's how early commerce, specifically for the Chinese community, popped up. And then, you know, partially, I think because of its volume, and then, you know, you get anti-Chinese and anti-Asian laws that popped up around the like early 1900s, late 1800s, that prevented people from settling permanently in like these other towns that they had. And there is kind of evidence around us, but those were not permanent places because of these laws. And people kind of ended up going back to San Francisco Chinatown as a result, because that was pretty much the only place that Asian Americans were allowed to, say, buy a business or own property.
Wow. So it became a refuge.
Yeah, exactly.
In a huge sense. So in what way is San Francisco's Chinatown story also indicative of the many Asian American enclaves that exist today in California?
Yeah. You know, I think that there is, and that's probably maybe the nugget that stays with San Francisco Chinatown today, is that there absolutely is that pride in the fact that this place was a sanctuary, a true sanctuary for Asian Americans for a very, very long time. But, you know, at the end of the day, I also think that San Francisco's Chinatown is that classic story of an immigrant enclave that has evolved over generations. Here's Andrew Leong. He's a professor at UMass Boston who studies Chinatowns, just talking about that universal feeling of belonging that we find in any Chinatown across the country.
We find a sense of belonging and security in this particular place. It is sanctuary for us. And that's why, you know, we gravitate and we want to make sure that, you know, Chinatowns exist, not just for the Chinese, really, but for all Asian Americans, you know, into the next generations.
I think we first saw Chinatown, like you said, a true refuge for Chinese immigrants who literally weren't allowed to settle elsewhere. But we've also seen how times have changed, the residents have moved out, how they've been replaced by newer immigrants, some of whom may not necessarily be Chinese or from the same region of China, which I think is important to note. And I think you can see this trajectory happening in lots of neighborhoods across the country, whether it's, you know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, or even more ethnic specific neighborhoods here in Sacramento.
Right. I mean, I'm from L.A., so I think not only of Chinatown, but I think of Japantown, Koreatown as well. And there are similar issues surrounding that. So when did these other enclaves begin popping up?
Yeah. So I think the surprising thing that I found in diving into this question of what happens when we lose our Chinatown, I think that we start to see a newer wave of, and I'm just using Chinatown broadly. Of course, I also mean Japantown, Koreatown, these sort of like neighborhoods that are sanctuaries. I think probably around the 80s or 90s is when you start to see that like upward mobility of those former residents who lived in Chinatown, who are now looking to achieve the American dream, but maybe also looking for that same sense of belonging and security. Obviously, everyone wants to kind of live around people who are kind of share their own the same values, same cultural ties. And so I think it's super fascinating then to kind of turn our lens to the San Gabriel Valley in Los Angeles, which I'm sure most people are familiar with. Here's Ryan Liu. He's a resident of the San Gabriel Valley, talking about what it was like for him to grow up there as a Chinese American.
Yeah, I think what makes this place special, and I think a lot of other diaspora communities can relate to this, is that when I'm in this area, you know, I don't really have to change who I am, and that this place sort of, it represents me, and I feel like a good representative of the area.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's important to note here that the San Gabriel Valley, as I believe you've covered already, was kind of marketed specifically for Chinese Americans who were moving out of Chinatown. Ryan Liu is a great example. His family initially settled in Los Angeles Chinatown and then moved out to the suburbs and were looking for a place to buy. And the San Gabriel Valley is a place that is extremely friendly towards Asian Americans. And so I kind of thought it was really awesome to see that this like feeling of belonging could be preserved just in like a slightly different place.
Oh, yeah. Growing up, I knew that the San Gabriel Valley was really where, I guess, growing up, I was told it was like the true Chinatown and where you really got like the best, for me, the best Asian American food. So totally. In Sacramento, though, I mean, we may not have a Chinatown per se, but there are Asian American communities with a similar story or just commonalities. I mean, I think of Little Saigon in the south part of the city, also the town of Locke in the county along the Delta. What can you tell us about these places?
Yeah. So I think you mentioned two really just interesting places that are both on different ends of the spectrum in terms of those trajectories that we typically see in these sorts of neighborhoods. So I think on the one hand, you have Locke, which, you know, has almost gone entirely in one direction. It's a town that used to have a very strong Chinese American presence, but today there's almost no Chinese Americans who actually live there. And it's mostly a museum to the former Chinese population. And it's kind of a tourist spot. Like, yeah, you go there and you're not really going to eat like authentic Chinese food or authentic Chinese American food. Little Saigon is newer, though. There is a very large concentration of Vietnamese Americans who live there. And that kind of came up in the 80s, 90s. But we're starting to see maybe, again, that typical American migration out. There are still businesses there that serve the Vietnamese population. But when I did reporting there last year, you know, a lot of younger residents are moving away. And honestly, that's what the hope is for these places. When you come and you bring your family, you kind of do hope, at least for the folks in Little Saigon, when I spoke with them, the hope is kind of that you establish your business, you gain economic security and an economic footing, so then the next generation can move out.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sarah Mises-Tan, the host of CAP Radio's new podcast, Mid-Pacific, about the evolution and the meaning behind Asian American enclaves like Chinatowns. So you do this wide canvas across the state. We go to San Francisco, you go down to the San Gabriel Valley in Southern California. When talking to Asian Americans, with obviously each have their own story, their own identity, how did they help you better understand what Chinatowns or other enclaves mean to them today compared to the original inception of them?
I think the big takeaway is really that these places are temporary. And in a way that kind of makes me sad, you know, as an Asian American who feels it's so important for us to have spaces where we can feel true belonging, like Ryan Liu mentioned, it is sad to kind of know that, yeah, maybe this is a place that you feel belonging right now, but it may not be the same way for your kids or the next generation or even in the next 20 years. And, you know, I think that's natural. But of course, I also think that it's important to note that there is kind of a difference. And that's kind of what I try to tease out in this podcast, is that for Asian Americans, you're constantly being asked where you're from, where you're from. You want to kind of like pull like a place in America as a place that you're from. And having that place where you feel belonging be a little slippery makes this, it kind of feels like this like never-ending task in a way.
Yeah, and you also talk about just, you know, the bittersweetness that comes with nostalgia, right? And,
totally.
And which is so understandable and so human. I mean, from San Francisco to, you talked about Locke as well in Sac County. I mean, have places like that really just become more for tourists to experience the culture and the food?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So I think maybe when there isn't a strong eye towards preservation or towards making sure that a community is still serving the population that it originally was formed around or the immigrant population that it was formed around, I think it's really easy for these places to slip into a different role, from facing inwards and serving their community to kind of outwardly facing and serving tourists and packaging. You know, I'm thinking of like a lot of the stores when you walk along San Francisco, Chinatown, the main boulevard now. But, you know, packaging, quote unquote, Asian for non-Asians, which kind of makes me feel uncomfortable, or it makes you feel weird as an Asian person. I'm thinking, those stores with the Asian trinkets that Asian people don't actually buy, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Given that you also explore these newer Asian ethnic enclaves, I mean, going back to the 80s and 90s in the San Gabriel Valley, communities like Monterey Park, when did these communities really begin developing? Was that really the marker, like the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, I think so. So a lot of the newer enclaves, I would say, at least from what I've heard, 1980s, maybe the 1970s, and then into the early 1990s, Little Saigon and Sacramento. And then we also in our podcast explore Cambodia Town in Long Beach, which did kind of come to fruition in the 1990s with an immigration of Cambodian immigrants to California. I think it's interesting to just hear how these places are now beginning to grapple with that idea that as you achieve economic security and the American dream, you know, they've been there, what, like 30, 40, 50 years now. You're having the next generation kind of looking at, okay, well, like, what does it mean to be Asian American? What does it mean to be Asian American in this space? And do I even want to be Asian American in this space? Does it still hold relevance for me? I think it's interesting to see, especially in our conversations in Cambodia Town, hearing that younger generation grapple with that question of, do I move away or do I start a business that's kind of relevant to me and my peers? And we preserve the sense and this pride that comes in living here. But it may not be exactly what our parents had in mind. You know, maybe our parents thought the American dream was moving out to the suburbs or something, and we end up wanting to stay here.
Oh, I'm just... All the light bulbs are popping up for a lot of people when it comes to pursuing your life in a way that perhaps your parents or elders didn't want you to. This is just so interesting. Finally, Sarah, your podcast, it's really, you led with it. You're exploring this feeling of in-betweenness, right? This being between two worlds. What does it tell you that Asian towns, they're evolving, as we're learning, But they're not disappearing, and they're not just simply transforming away from its original intention.
Yeah, so I hate to repeat what you've said, but truly, I think the evolution of these Asian American spaces really is the physical embodiment of feeling in between. You know, when we went to Cambodia Town, spoke with some of the younger generation there, a lot of them mentioned, and, you know, I think the Cambodian immigration experience is something that's very particular in itself, which we also get into in this episode. But they kind of mentioned that, like, being Cambodian in itself, it was hard to have a sense of Cambodian identity when they were living in Cambodia. And when they came over to America, Cambodia Town kind of served as a place for them to reinvent the idea of being Cambodian. And so there is a drive and at least maybe a desire to kind of preserve that and kind of keep that idea evolving with the younger generations who say, you know, they don't have a whole lot of experience with actual Cambodia. But Cambodian American, they know, they feel that it's important to preserve that since, yeah, I don't know, I'm kind of talking myself in circles here, but it can be a little bit fluid.
Yeah.
But, you know, as our expert Andrew Leong mentioned, it's really important that we try to preserve these places in some sort of way and keep them so that they're still serving Asian Americans, because these are truly those original spaces of belonging in America for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
Sarah Mises-Tan is the host of Mid-Pacific. That is Cap Radio's new podcast. And new episodes drop on Thursdays. Today, we dove into the evolution of Asian enclaves like Chinatowns and what place they hold today for Asian Americans and their sense of belonging. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Insight's Concert Connect sets you up with great music in the Sacramento area and beyond. This time, we're taking a drive through I-80 to Roseville. We're heading to Midtown Sacramento and paying Oakland a visit. Helping us unpack the best concert experiences to check out and soak in are Cap Radio's Andrew Garcia and Nick Bruner. Their range of musical artists would rival a Tower Records in its heyday, R.I.P.
And now I think she's making fun of us. I think we've been a couple of weeks of this, and I've been observing it. I don't know about you, but I feel like maybe this is just a little...
Tower Records, I mean, maybe we're on our way out. Who knows?
It is, but with all sincerity, and I'm going to steal this from you, Andrew. Andrew and Nick are our tunesome friends.
Aww.
Just thinking about the word tunesome, thanks to you, a couple days ago.
Should be used more.
Yeah, it should be, and we are. I'm following in that spirit. Okay, so you have set up some really cool and very interesting acts that are going to be performing in our area in the next 2 weeks. The first one is Rituals of Mine. Mm. That's a familiar name, led by Tara Lopez. No stranger to Cap Radio, no stranger to Insight. Tara is wonderful. They have these like really heavy bass lines, atmospheric sounds, thoughtful lyrics that just work so well. So Tara is originally from Sacramento, but Nick, I mean, you have a relationship. You guys go back professionally. You've seen them play many, many times. Mm-hmm. How did you first discover Rituals of Mine?
Totally by accident. It was actually through Tara's like project about maybe two projects ago called The Evening Episode. I was at Old Ironsides, and there was this warm synth-driven, wonderfully just composed piece of just electronic music that had this soaring vocal over top of it. And that was my first interaction with seeing Tara Lopez perform. And the Evening Episode wrapped up shortly after I saw that show, but Tara has been just plugging away through her projects, formerly known as Sister Crayon, now Rituals of Mine. And it's been really fun watching her grow and develop her sound into what it is today.
So Rituals of Mine is going to be playing at the Starlit Room. That's in Harlow's in Sacramento, April 11th, next week.
Yes.
Talk to us about the Hype Nostalgia album. What stands out to you?
Well, it's great. This is the first time that this collection of music is going to be toured around, thanks to COVID. The album came out in 2020, so Tara hasn't actually had a chance to properly tour the music yet. So it kicks off tonight in Seattle, and she'll be back in for the hometown show here on Tuesday. Hype Nostalgia is filled with a lot of heavy themes. And for as positive and dynamic as Tara is in person, she has had to go through an awful lot as a human being to get her here. And music has been such a huge part in her being able to kind of vent, de-stress, you know, emote. The loss of her father, there's elements of her growing up in South Sac and losing her home, elements of homelessness throughout her life. She's one of the most positive people I've ever met. And if she didn't have music, I don't know what would be, what her outlet would be. But I'm glad she has it. And I'm glad we all have it, because it's really, really cathartic and wonderful, warm stuff.
Well, let's take a listen to 65th Street.
We were lying down when we heard the news, long before you ever called. I didn't want to believe what was said. My life against the wall. Mother is afraid of me, all of the history. Now I have no choice but to wonder why. All I ever wondered, all I ever wondered, is if you are the source, you are the source, you are the source of my emptiness.
Gift. That is going to be awesome on April 11th at Harlow's.
It's her ode to growing up in South Sacramento, and just, again, it kind of comes back to thinking about how she grew up. It's one night around Christmas, the garage that she was staying in caught fire. She and her brother were there, and she says luckily she has asthma, so the smoke woke her up. But she nearly died, nearly lost everything, and it's just, she's been channeling like experiences like that into, I think, this album especially. Yeah. So, but yeah, a lot of catharsis coming out in this one.
Wow. All right. So our next band is They Might Be Giants, and we're going to be heading to Oakland. They're going to be performing at the Fox Theater April 16th. Our producer, Victor, had to remind me that this is the band who performed the theme song to the 2000s hit show, Malcolm in the Middle.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Most folks have heard They Might Be Giants. They just didn't know it.
Yeah. So how would you describe They Might Be Giants to someone who maybe has listened to them, but doesn't, they can't pin a song on the band?
The first word that comes to mind is absurd, but a delightful and most importantly, a really well-crafted absurdity is very key. I've found it sort of really rare that artists like these who have such a fun and silly sensibility are also the same people that are like experts at their craft. And the most like the other artist that I found is a good comparison point would probably be Robin Williams, who's definitely undeniably silly and has a sort of sees the world in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious at stand-up, really skilled comedic actor, dramatic actor. And I think They Might Be Giants has that same sort of balance and range in the work that they do. So they've got these really great melodies that they're able to craft that are instant sort of earworms. Malcolm in the Middle, everybody can still sing that song to this day. And they have enough sort of musical skill to take those melodies and put them in any genre that they want. And it's a great time. So stuff like alt rock, pop, polka, children's music even, and the sort of ska slash big band vibes of the track that we're going to listen to.
Yeah, and they go back decades. So we're going to take a listen to They Might Be Giants, a song, Dr. Worm, from their 1998 album, Severe Tire Damage.
They call me Dr. Worm. Good morning, how are you? I'm Dr. Worm. I'm interested in things. I'm not a real doctor, but I am a real worm. I am an actual worm. I live like a worm. I like to play the drums. I think I'm getting good, but I can handle criticism. Show you what I know, and you can tell me if you think I'm getting better on the drums. I'll leave the front unlocked, cause I can't hear the doorbell.
He's bringing me back to middle school.
Yeah,
I'm dating myself.
I've
but
taken to calling it children's music for adults.
Yes, yeah. I love it. And obviously, they've been so successful because they're still touring decades later.
They're still touring. They have a bunch of great different albums. They're super prolific. If there are any parents out there looking to get their kids sort of into the next step of like listening to the Bluey theme song every day to like some cool new next music, They Might Be Giants, I think, is the one.
Awesome. Well, another great thing about Insight's Concert Connects and the two of you is that you discovered obviously new music with and share it with our listeners and with myself included. So your new discovery is Snail Mail, which is fronted by Lindsay Jordan. And Jordan released her sophomore album, Valentine, back in 2021 at the age of 20 years old. But what we enjoy are these like deep, profound lyrics that really just mix so well with instrumentals. How did you come across Snail Mail, Andrew?
I think around 2018, when their sort of first big label release came out, it was called Lush. And that album, Nick, you might remember, just absolutely blew up in like the indie blogosphere type of thing.
Huge.
And so, you know, being the avowed hipster that I am, I had to tune in. But it was that sort of lyrical honesty and like vulnerability that I think draws a lot of people in past the first listen and to keep listening. And outside of just the lyrical, Lindsay Jordan can also like shred. She's been playing the guitar since about 5 years old. So you can hear a lot of that skilled guitar work in this sort of murky, shoegazy 90s vibe that is in a lot of Snail Mail songs and sort of turned into a completely new sort of sound, which I like a lot.
Awesome. Well, let's take a listen because Snail Mail is performing in Roseville at Goldfield Trading Post on Wednesday, April 19th. And this track is titled Valentine.
Just 2 months due. I'm older now, believe me, I adore you. So why'd you wanna erase me? Darling Valentine, you'll always know where to find me.
That's going to be an awesome concert as well.
Yeah. And I'm hoping sometime soon we get some new Snail Mail music as well.
Yep. You can plug that. Heard first on Insight, Andrew's request.
There you go. You're welcome.
All right. So we have like 2 minutes left. Our next group is Hiatus Coyote. Did I say that correctly?
Coyote, like the
coyote
animal.
They're going to be at the Fox Theater, Oakland, April 20th. Why did you choose them?
R&B, funk, and jazz-inflected hip-hop. They like to call it future soul. I think they're just such a unique act. They're a Melbourne, Australia quartet. Lots of syncopated rhythms to keep your brain doing hopscotch from beat to beat to beat. This tune is one of my favorites. It's off of a recent record, I want to say about 2 years ago, from Mood Valiant. Its remix record just came out called Mood Variant. This is called Get Sun, featuring the legendary Arthur Fairkai.
As always, I appreciate the range, you two. All of them are awesome.
Oh, thanks, Vicky.
Yeah, thanks.
Such our pleasure. We didn't write any of this, I don't think, did we?
Any of the music? No.
No, okay.
Not involved.
Yeah, but no.
You're just sharing it for all of us to enjoy. That's Cap Radio host Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia sharing their quickly approaching concert selections for Insight's Concert Connect. As always, you can listen to Hey Listen Saturdays from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. and again from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Also, be sure to follow Cap Radio on Instagram, where Nick and Andrew's concert picks are posted on the app. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.